I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday suggested displaced Palestinians in Gaza be permanently resettled outside the war-torn territory.
You can't live in Gaza right now, and I think we need another location. I think it should be a location that's going to make people happy. You look over the decades, it's all death in Gaza. This has been happening for years. It's all death. If we can get a beautiful area to resettle people permanently in nice homes and where they can be happy and not be shot, not be killed, not be knifed to death like what's happening in Gaza.
Trump made the comments at the start of a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where the two leaders were expected to discuss the fragile ceasefire and hostage deal in the Israeli-Hamas conflict. The president has previously called on Egypt and Jordan to resettle Gazans. Both countries have flatly rejected such proposals. The first U.S. military flight to deport migrants from the United States to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, departed on Tuesday. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The flight from the U.S. to Guantanamo Bay is the first step in what's expected to be a surge in the number of migrants held at the Navy base in Cuba, which was primarily used to detain foreigners associated with the 9/11 attacks. President Trump has said the facility can hold 30,000. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was assigned to Guantanamo Bay when he was on active duty. He calls it the perfect place to house migrants. But Amnesty International's Amy Fisher says sending immigrants to Guantanamo is cruel and costly and cuts people off from lawyers and family. Trump has been actively deporting with flights to India, Ecuador, Guam, Honduras, and Peru. I'm Julie Walker.
This is VOA News. President Trump on Tuesday said he's exploring whether he can legally move ahead with El Salvador's offer to accept and jail violent American criminals. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It was an unusual offer. El Salvador's president told Secretary of State Marco Rubio the Central American nation would take American deportees of any nationality, including Americans imprisoned for violent crimes.
If we had the legal right to do it, I would do it in a heartbeat. I don't know if we do or not. We're looking at that right now.
Hours earlier in Costa Rica, Rubio noted the obvious legalities involved.
We have a constitution. We have all sorts of things.
Yet noted it's a very generous, incredible, unprecedented offer.
No one's ever made an offer like that.
Saying it would let the U.S. outsource some of its most dangerous criminals at a fraction of the cost of imprisoning them in America. Sagar Magani, Washington.
China announced retaliatory tariffs on select American imports and an antitrust investigation into Google on Tuesday, just minutes after a sweeping levy on Chinese products imposed by President Trump took effect. China and the U.S. engaged in a trade war in 2018 when Trump raised tariffs on Chinese goods and China responded in kind. Analysts say China is much better prepared to counter this time around, but also wary about taking steps that could upset its own fragile and heavily trade-dependent economy. American tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico were also set to go into effect Tuesday before Trump agreed to a 30-day pause as the two countries acted to address his concerns about border security and drug trafficking. Police in central Sweden were investigating the motive for a mass shooting at an adult education center on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
A local police chief said that, quote, 10 or so people were killed in the shooting, telling a news conference that he couldn't be more exact about the death toll at that time because, quote, the extent of the incident is so large. He also said the gunman is believed to be among those killed. The search for victims went into the evening, as Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson spoke to reporters.
It is difficult to take in the magnitude of what has happened today, the darkness that is now falling over Sweden tonight. Today, we have seen a brutal, deadly violence against completely innocent people. This is the worst mass shooting in Swedish history.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Eric Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, February 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. East African leaders seek a resolution to the conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
The two leaders have got to agree that they will not be a mutual threat to each other, and then Rwanda on its part also needs to be given assurances that the DRC will not allow the FDLR to continue operating from its soil.
Chadians who work for now-departed French troops appeal to government for jobs. A new survey by Afrobarometer says Africans are likely to prioritize their national identity over their ethnic one. Nigeria announces measures to cushion the impact of suspension of the USAID support.
What this means is they are going to do a review, situation assessment of what's going on, and that will be able to give them opportunity to make a recommendation to the government.
And South Sudanese are concerned about delay in the establishment of a hybrid court to address war crimes. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Donald Trump vowed on Tuesday that the U.S. would take over the war-ravaged Gaza Strip after Palestinians are resettled elsewhere and develop it economically, a move that would shadow decades of U.S. policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Associated Press reports that Trump unveiled his surprise plan without providing specifics at a joint press conference with visiting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The announcement followed Trump's shock proposal earlier on Tuesday for the permanent resettlement of Palestinians from Gaza to neighboring countries, calling the enclave where the first phase of a fragile ceasefire is in effect a demolition site. Asked what would life, who would live there, Trump said it will become a home to the world's people. But Trump did not directly respond to a question of how and under what authority that the U.S. can take over the land of Gaza and occupy it in the long run. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government has described the unilateral ceasefire declared by Rwanda-backed rebels in eastern DRC as a false communication, while the United Nations on Tuesday noted reports of heavy fighting with Congolese forces in the region. The M23 rebels on Monday announced the ceasefire on humanitarian grounds after pleas for the safe passage of aid and hundreds of thousands of displaced people. But DRC's spokesperson told the Associated Press and other journalists that all we are waiting for is the withdrawal of the M23. The M23 last week seized control of Goma, a city of 2 million people at the heart of a region home to trillions of dollars in minerals wealth. Aid groups are rushing to help thousands of wounded and displaced in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, while regional leaders are planning a summit that they hope can bring together the presidents of DRC and Rwanda and find a solution to the crisis. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The streets of Goma in eastern Congo were busy Tuesday after the M23 rebel group announced a ceasefire to allow humanitarian supplies to reach hundreds of thousands affected by the past week's fighting between M23 and pro-Congolese government forces. The group has also halted its military advance in other areas, most notably around the South Kivu provincial capital of Bukavu, where M23 fighters are stationed a few kilometers from the town. Crispin Mvano, a political and security expert in Goma, told VOA that people there were going about their business peacefully.
Hali ya Goma ni shwari kwa sasa sababu,
he says, residents in the city center report seeing numerous trucks carrying petrol and other goods from Tanzania, Uganda and Rwanda. Many people who fled the conflict are also returning, and immigration officers are busy with arrivals. It seems calm is gradually returning to the city. The M23 ceasefire comes hours after the East African Community, or EAC, and Southern Africa Regional Community agreed to hold a joint summit to discuss the conflict in Congo in hopes of bringing the differences between Kinshasa and Rwanda. Congo accuses Kigali of supporting the M23, a claim denied by Rwanda but verified by UN observers. According to UN agencies, 770 bodies were recovered from the streets of Goma and 2,880 were injured in the conflict. The Red Cross said Monday that it will need four more days to collect the bodies. Due to a lack of morgue space, it says all bodies will be buried after identification. Hassani Hamdo is a Norwegian Refugee Council Regional Director for Central and West Africa. He says the ceasefire is only a first step.
The ceasefire is, of course, welcome, but we need to stress that only lasting peace can bring relief in Eastern Congo and allow life-saving assistance to reach those who are in desperate need.
Stéphane Dujarric, spokesperson for UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, said UN agencies are assessing the situation and are developing a plan to distribute humanitarian aid to displaced people in Congo and neighboring countries. The UN Humanitarian Affairs Office is calling for the urgent reopening of the Goma airport to help with the evacuation of the injured and delivery of medical supplies. The agency said those involved in the conflict must guarantee those in need access to humanitarian aid and supplies. Mvano says Eastern Congo's armed groups could spoil the lull in fighting. He says the ceasefire remains fragile due to the presence of other armed groups involved in the conflict between government forces and M23. The Wazalendo group, for example, frequently disrupt peace efforts. Even if the Congolese government and M23 agree to a ceasefire, fighting could continue as these heavily armed rebel groups, who are not part of the negotiations, refuse to recognize the agreement. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
An expert in international security and diplomacy at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, Kenya, says Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo need to find a negotiated settlement to the conflict in eastern DRC. Edgar Gitua spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga.
They will definitely have a temporal solution. The solution, one of the solutions would have been the ceasefire, an agreement to more structured dialogues, because the problem in DRC currently is Rwanda's issue with claiming FDLR are there, and of course, has issue that M23 are Rwandese. So granted, yes, the M23 have been supported by Rwanda for many years, but with good reason. And the good reason is simply, if you go back into history, the people who actually created the FDLR and empowered them to be a threat to Rwanda was President Kabila, the senior, Laurent Kabila, the one who died. So he's the one who armed them. He's the one who gave us Interahamwe weapons, and he meant to use them as a weapon against Rwanda. And so Rwanda also now armed M23 and came up as a way of trying to protect themselves. So the two leaders have got to agree that they will not be a mutual threat to each other. And number two, that M23 is comprised of Congolese Tutsis. Those are not Rwandese. Those are Congolese Tutsis. Yes, granted, they speak the same language, they speak Kinyarwanda, but they were born and raised in Congo. So he needs to treat them as such. And then Rwanda on its part also needs to be given assurances that the DRC will not allow the FDLR to continue operating from its soil, so that now Rwanda does not feel the need to keep on crossing the border to go and try and solve that problem. So it is a security problem, it's an identity problem, and it can be solved. Not everything will be done overnight, but at least I am seeing these talks. If both parties are open to dialogue, both parties at least can begin that structured dialogue to understand. At least that much I expect to come from the SADC meeting.
How about the issue of capturing territory and even threats of moving on to Kinshasa?
King of Rwanda and M23 are not serious about going to Kinshasa, but they are putting that threat to remind President Tshisekedi and Kinshasa that it has been done in the past. It is Rwanda and Uganda who supported Laurent Kabila to go and overthrow and take over Kinshasa when Mobutu was there. So there is precedence. So this is just a way of forcing Tshisekedi to the negotiating table. But from where I sit, the threat of marching to Kinshasa, I don't think it is possible right now, because it will invite international intervention. And if Rwanda supports, let's say, assuming Rwanda is the country behind this push, it cannot be able to sustain that kind of a conflict in this day and age. The international community and other countries in Africa will not allow that to happen. So it is just a threat to get Tshisekedi to the negotiating table in YZ.
Edgar Gutua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He spoke from the Kenyan capital with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 5th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Nigerian officials have launched a committee to develop a plan for transition and sustainability for USAID-funded health programs following U.S. President Donald Trump's 90-day halt of most foreign aid. The multi-ministerial committee aims to secure new financial support for critical health programs. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigeria's health minister said the committee, comprising officials from the ministries of finance, health, and environment, intends to ensure that patients receiving treatment for HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria do not experience setbacks amid the uncertainty of U.S. foreign policy. Shortly after taking office 2 weeks ago, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered a 90-day pause on U.S. foreign aid. But days later, he approved a temporary waiver for life-saving humanitarian assistance covering medicine, medical services, food, and shelter. Despite the exemption, concerns remain over the future of U.S. funding for global health programs. Public health analyst Ejike Orji welcomed Nigeria's proactive response to the U.S. funding freeze.
What this means is they are going to do a review, situation assessment of what's going on, and that will be able to give them opportunity to make a recommendation to the government. They gave a 90-day review because of the strategic importance of continuing the HIV program in Nigeria. They gave a waiver. So that means there's still a possibility at the end of 90 days after their review, they might say, look, we don't want to continue this funding.
Nigeria is a significant recipient of U.S. foreign aid, receiving $1.02 billion in 2023, much of it through agencies like the USAID. USAID funding to Nigeria plays a pivotal role in HIV and AIDS treatment, maternal and child care, and disease prevention efforts. On Monday, the Nigerian Federal Executive Council approved $1 billion for healthcare sector reforms and allocated an additional $3.2 million to procure 150,000 HIV treatment packs over the next 4 months. Authorities said the new funding will support improvements in primary healthcare services, maternal and child healthcare, and training of healthcare professionals. But Ndayo Aiwat, General Secretary of the Health Sector Reforms Coalition, says it will be difficult to sustain those programs without continued U.S. support.
Even when they are releasing the available funds on time and stuff, they will not be able to cover all the areas that those funds were helping them to achieve. So it will take probably 2-3 years.
Approximately 1.8 million Nigerians are living with HIV. The country also accounts for the world's highest number of malaria deaths and ranks among the top countries for tuberculosis cases. Currently, only about 4% of Nigeria's annual budget is allocated to the health sector, far below the 15% target set by African leaders in the 2001 Abuja Declaration. It's unclear whether the U.S. will reverse its decision after the 90-day pause, but with uncertainty looming, analysts say careful implementation of policies and new partnerships may be Nigeria's best path forward. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
More than 400 civilians rendered jobless by the departure of French troops from Chad are asking their government to hire them and provide the job benefits they had when they worked for France. The last French troops left Chad on January 31st following an order by President Mohamed Idriss Deby Itno. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Chadian officials say hundreds of civilians who were employed by the French assembled in the capital N'Djamena on Monday to ask the government to immediately give them jobs. French forces departed Chad at the order of the Central African States President, Field Marshal Mohamed Idriss Deby. The last French troops left the country on Friday after handing over the Kosei military base in N'Djamena, which they had occupied for about 70 years. Earlier, French forces handed over two other bases at Faya Lajo and Abeche, Mbai Tubam Bruno is the spokesperson for civilians who worked at the French military base. He spoke to VOA from Jamena via a messaging app.
Le licenciement que nous avons subi, qualifié de licenciement économique par l'inspection du travail.
He says Chad's government should immediately recruit them because at least half of the over 400 Chadians who lost their jobs as French troops departed are already in precarious situations that do not permit them to support their families. Mbai Tubam says it is imperative for Chad's government to guarantee the security and social well-being of all former workers at French military bases by making sure each and every one of them has a job. The former workers mostly held jobs in hospitals, schools, and dining facilities that served the French troops. Others provided humanitarian assistance to those who lived around the bases. Mbai Tubam said a majority of the workers were asked to leave French military bases on November 28 when Chad announced an end to military cooperation with France. The workers say they have remained without jobs and salaries and cannot take care of their medical bills. Aziz Muhammad Saleh is a member of a Chadian commission overseeing the dismantling of military agreements between Paris and N'Djamena. He is also Chad's former communications minister and government spokesperson. He says Chad's president, Field Marshal Mohamed Idriss Déby, ordered the commission to make a census of all civilians who worked with French troops in the three bases of Kosei, Faya Lajo, and Abeche. He says after the census, the commission will propose a list of workers whose services are needed to the government of Chad for recruitment. Mohamed spoke on Chad State TV. He said Déby has asked health and humanitarian workers to continue working in hospitals formerly controlled by French troops. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A new survey by Afrobarometer, the Pan-African Research Network, says Africans are likely to prioritize their national identity over their ethnic one or to equally feel allegiance to both. In a survey conducted across 33 countries, Afrobarometer also found that Africans have no objection to living next door to people from different ethnic backgrounds and are open to inter-ethnic marriages. Maika Chumazala is one of the researchers. She tells me that only a small minority in all countries expressed allegiance to their ethnic identity.
I would say that the findings show that Africans are likely to prioritize their national identity over their ethnic one or to feel an allegiance to both equally. And only a small minority put their ethnic identity first. However, when we look at trends, we see that there's a slight decline in the strong national identity over the years.
In which country or countries would you say national identity and ethnic identity are prevalent? And does it say anything specific about these countries?
So we see an overwhelming majority, about 92% of Mauritanians express that they feel primarily connected to their national identity. This is followed by 79% in Guinea and 69% in Congo-Brazzaville. We see a majority take this position in five other countries. This includes Niger, Morocco, Senegal, Burkina Faso, and the Gambia. And in 11 countries, including Liberians, Ghanaians, Ugandans, Botswana, the majorities are equally attached to both ethnic and national identities. Now, only a few majorities in countries express primary allegiance to ethnic identity. Actually, it is a minority position in all countries, and only three countries record as high as like a quarter of their citizens saying that they identify more with their ethnicity. This includes Nigeria, where we see 27%, South Africa with 26%, and Ethiopia with 24%.
What lessons should we draw from this? In other words, why did Afrobarometer feel the need to do this survey?
I think the big highlight of our findings was that there are some deficits in social trust, and not just due to trust among ethnic groups, but we also see this with people from other religions and other people, you know. So the deficit in social trust, while it is substantial, does not adhere specifically to ethnicity, but reflects this general attitude of limited trust toward people outside one's individual immediate family and community. However, besides this deficit in social trust, we're seeing that a lot of Africans, in fact, most Africans, embrace coexistence. We see 90% have no objection to living next door to people of different ethnicities, and 89% are open to interethnic marriages within their families. So I think this suggests, these findings suggest that interethnic relations in Africa are very complex, and they are more complex than simply being divisive or harmonious. I think it's an opportunity for governments to really think about what ethnic identity means to their citizens and how they can improve, I guess, social trust in their communities.
Makwe Chumazala is one of the researchers of the latest Afro Barometer survey about national and ethnic identities in Africa. The 2018 revitalized peace agreement mandated establishment of a hybrid court to address war crimes and atrocities committed during South Sudan's 2013 conflict. However, more than 7 years later, the court has yet to be established, raising doubts about accountability and justice for victims of the conflict. Sheila Pony has more from Juba.
Chapter 5 of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement focuses on transitional justice, outlining mechanisms for addressing past grievances, promoting reconciliation, and ensuring accountability for human rights violations committed during the civil war. Key components include the establishment of a hybrid court to investigate and prosecute those responsible for crimes against humanity and war crimes, along with the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing, and the Reparation and Compensation Authority. Michael Makwe, Minister of Information in South Sudan's Revitalized Transitional Government of National Unity, says under the agreement, the government is not responsible for forming the hybrid court.
The formation of the hybrid court is not in our hands. It is the African Union. She's supposed to give us the terms and reference terms of the formation, terms and conditions for the enactment of the law. The African Union, up to now, has not yet given us any terms and conditions, so that based on these terms and conditions, the Ministry of Justice will draft a bill.
Jerome Makoma Biswaro, the African Union envoy to South Sudan, says the African Union has been working on the issue.
The AU is now starting to draft the guidelines, which will be shared with the government. And once that is agreed upon by the two parties, then things will go as planned.
The Revitalized Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, an international body that monitors the implementation of the 2018 agreement, says the parties to the deal are responsible for forming the court. The chairperson of Commission, Ambassador General Charles Tai Gitwai, says his group will continue to remind the parties about their obligations.
RJ has robustly pushed for the establishment of a court in various ways. For example, through holding regular RJMEC plenary meetings on the stressing for the need to have the establishment of this court.
Gitwai says the African Union Commission holds the primary responsibility for establishing the court.
It is incumbent upon the African Union Commission to provide the terms on the establishment of a hybrid court. Our understanding is that...
That was reporter Sheila Pony reporting from Juba, South Sudan. And that's it. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely day.